Ron Pattinson joins me this week to discuss the history of Berliner Weisse. This is Beersmith Podcast number 257.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 257, and it's early May 2022. Ron Pattinson joins me this week to discuss the history of Berliner Weisse. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And the web-based version of Beersmith is available with a new inventory module now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. The web-based version gives you access to tens of thousands of recipes, online recipe editing, advanced water tools, and much more. You can try Beersmith for the Web for 30 days by setting up a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version of Beersmith for one low price. Check out beersmithrecipes.com now to give Beersmith Web a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Ron Pattinson. Ron is the author of dozens of books on historical beer brewing and runs a blog called Shut Up About Barclay Perkins at barclayperkins.blogspot.com. Today, we're going to discuss Berliner Weisse. Ron, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
Oh, okay. Still researching away all the time.
You have put out voluminous projects on historical brewing. Obviously, what project are you working on right now?
Well, I should really have finished, but it's just about finished a book on World War II, brewing in World War II, which is a bit rather large. So that'll have to come out in two volumes, one of which will just be homebrew recipes. So, and then I'm already working on the project after that, which is about British beer between 1880 and 1914. So
that's awesome. I mean, we discussed the ones that you did on World War One, and I think on the last episode I had you on, we discussed World War Two. But I imagine the period before that's interesting as well. The article you sent me starts with a statement that a lot of beer history common wisdom is bollocks. So what do you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of stories that have been retold. It's getting slightly better nowadays. Well, a lot better. But there's still often stories which have no basis in reality, which are thrown around as if they were. So some things people say can be, well, people write can be pretty annoying. Some of the stuff about IPA is irritating.
What specifically about IPAs?
About them being strong beers, which they weren't particularly by the standards of the day.
Were they actually designed to go to India and all this other stuff? Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. And they were heavily hopped, so they'd last the journey better as well. But the other thing people generally don't talk about is the role of Brettanomyces in aging IPA. So that one of the other defenses was that there was very little left in the beer. Everything had been fermented out. And that was done by a long secondary Brettanomyces fermentation before the beer went on the ship.
Which means, of course, it would have been sour, right?
No, not necessarily sour. The British strains of Britannomyces don't produce much acidity.
Hmm.
So there would have been a little bit, but it wouldn't have been a sour beer by any means. Well, I know from the one that we did. So I did one with Goose Island, this thing called Brewery Yard, and we aged it for 11 months with Britannomyces, and it turned out very nice, a bit like Orval.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, today you want to discuss the Berliner Weiss style, and you mentioned that this style is almost completely died out at the commercial level, which is something I was not aware in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, what you had was consolidation amongst the breweries in Berlin. So what you used to have was the big breweries were Kindle and Schultheis,
mm-hmm.
but it was confused by the fact that you had both of them in East and West Berlin, and which after the war had become separate companies, but they still used the same logos. It was really weird. And then basically after the war fell, West Berlin Kindle took over East Berlin Schultheis.
So they bought them out, I guess, or something like that?
Yeah. And then they bought out and just closed them, which was terrible because the Schultheis one was a really good Berliner Weisse. It was a brilliant beer. and then Kindle also bought West Berlin Schultheis and stopped brewing their Berliner Weisse, which, even though it hadn't been as good as the East Berlin one, was still a lot better than Kindle's own one, which is rubbish. And that's the only really one made on any large scale anymore. And it was by far the worst of the ones that they used to be brewed in Berlin.
You're saying there's really only one run brewed commercially, at least at any scale right now, right?
Yeah, so I think you've got Schneeoiler who are brewing stuff where they've, because there were a large number of old bottles of Berliner Weisse still knocking around. And people have been extracting the yeast and the Britannomyces in particular and brewing up beer using those, which is what I think Schneeoiler are doing. So they're trying quite hard to be authentic, even though I had a big argument with the woman who brews there about how acidic Berliner Weisse should be. We had quite different opinions.
So anyway. What was the difference of opinion, I guess?
Well, she thought it should be a lot less sour than I did.
Interesting.
But I've seen the chemical analyses. I know what it was. It was 3.2 or 3.3 pH.
The pH level, of course, it gives you a good indication of the acidity.
I've seen analyses of, I think, three or four different ones from the that were done in the 1970s, and they're all about like that.
Well, what are the commonly held historical legends behind this style? Because it is quite an interesting style.
Well, the one that I don't believe is the one that it was Huguenot refugees who brought Weiss beer brewing to Berlin. And one of the sort of well-known Berliner Weisse breweries in the 19th century was run by a family called Blondre, who were indeed Huguenot refugees, but I don't really believe that that's where it came from, seeing as beers of that general type were being brewed all over in North Germany. So I think it's more likely that it's a derivative of some other North German beer. I mean, some people have suggested Breuhahn. That's probably a fairly good candidate, seeing as that was the one that was most widely brewed. So it's just on statistical grounds, it's the most likely. And that's what some of the people reckon, that it's an adapted form of Breuhahn, which was this beer that was brewed all over the place for quite a long period of time and then completely disappeared. It's quite an intriguing beer, Breuhahn. Anyway, so the most plausible story is that it's developed from Breuhahn or something like Breuhahn, and just Berlin's own particular twist on that style or that general type of beer.
So about when do you think this particular beer style came of its own, really?
It's difficult to say because I haven't found much. I think the oldest proper reference I could find to Berliner Weisse was from 1773 in this encyclopedia, where it said a few things about the characteristics of it, not how it tasted, but that's typical of old descriptions. They virtually never tell you how a beer tastes. There's very few sensory descriptions of beer before 1900.
So what do they generally have, a recipe or?
Yeah, I mean, this was more saying that it was 2/3 wheat, 1/3 barley. It was brewed with a decoction mash, and that the hops were boiled in the decoction rather than having a separate boil. And that's a recurring theme that you'll see going on. Because, of course, they're having to be very careful with the hops. Because if a beer's too hoppy, then it's going to kill all the lactobacillus, and that's vital for the fermentation that you want to happen. So it means that they always have very low levels of hopping. And also, they'd be reluctant to boil it for too long because they wouldn't want to darken the colour because they wanted a nice pale beer. So there's various things going on. But it is interesting to know these details about how it was brewed.
So go into a little more detail on the, you know, that first description of what the style was like and how it was brewed. I think it's very interesting.
What I've told you is about it.
Oh, okay.
That's about all it says. But I mean, at least it does give you some idea of the recipe and of the brewing method. And it does point out one, you know, this one unusual thing that they did. Yeah, later on when you see the descriptions of them fermenting the mashed, and I find that a bit weird. I mean, I can understand you might want to.
Yeah, but you said that wasn't in the original one, right?
Sorry?
You said that wasn't in the original one, I guess?
Sorry, what wasn't the...
The fermenting of the mash tun wasn't in the original one, right?
No, that's not mentioned in the original one. I think that's slightly later, early 19th century. But, yeah, I mean, I suppose it saves you on vessels, but it means you're not going to be able to brew for days because your mash tun's got fermenting wort in it, so... Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand this whole mash tun thing. So they take the beer after it's been, you know, boiled and everything, and I guess move it back to the mash tun. I assume they remove the grains, right?
Yeah. I assume they move it. Yeah.
And then they ferment it in the mash tun, huh?
Yeah.
Now, do we have any idea what yeast they were using? I assume they're using local strains of some kind, right? Because obviously they didn't really understand yeast at that point.
Well, they seem to, at different times, they seem to have used yeast from different places. So in some periods, they'd be getting it from Cottbus. Other periods, they'd be getting it from other German towns. So it's slightly strange. And the reason seemed to be that the beer's got too sour. So that seems to be implying that that you hadn't really got a symbiosis between the yeast and the lactobacillus, but that the lactobacillus had taken over. Mm-hmm. And it's only, you see, in the beginning of the 19th century, so the 1830s or 1840s, where they managed to get the weird symbiotic culture that's used for brewing Berliner Weisse, certainly, well, you'd say traditionally, but since then, so for almost 200 years. So where you have, rather than pitching just yeast, you pitch this combination of yeast and lactobacillus, and they both ferment away, and somehow magically at the end of the process the proportion of them's the same, even though during the process itself it's not been the same. So it sort of magically goes back to where it had been when it started, the relative numbers of the two organisms. So it's a weird process, and I don't quite know how they managed to get that to work, probably just by accident, I would guess.
And of course, a lot of people like to make Berliner Weisse now because they use sort of a kettle souring method, right? Where you actually, kettle sour the beer before you reboil it and then ferment it. I assume they weren't using anything like this kind of a process in the past, though, right?
No, they did have some guy, Franke, who experimented doing it that way. And then they gave it up again because they couldn't get it to taste right.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then you had Kindle, which is what I was saying is not very authentic. Certainly in the 70s, what they were doing was two separate fermentations. So they'd be fermenting half of the wort with Saccharomyces at a normal sort of top fermenting temperature. And the other half they'd ferment, I think, 40 degrees with Lactobacillus. And then they'd blend the two back together again at the end of fermentation.
Interesting. But, so it was about a 50-50 split there?
Yeah, I think it was exactly 50-50. But the problem they had then had was because they pasteurized the one with the lactobacillus. And anyway, that they weren't getting the secondary fermentation with Brettanomyces, which you got with the ones who were using more traditional methods. And so they couldn't get the flavor right, which is what I always thought with Kendall. It did, that there was something that was missing from it. And now I know what it was. It was the Britannomyces character, which no one seemed to have noticed until the 1980s. It's the weird thing that you had this brewing scientist, Schoenfeld, who worked at the VLB in Berlin, which is like the brewing university in Berlin, so highly prestigious. He looked at the fermentation. This is how I know the thing about the balance between lactobacillus and saccharomyces, because he looked at the fermentation in huge detail and was recording the amounts of the things and stuff. But somehow he never managed to notice the Britannomyces.
Interesting.
And it wasn't until the 80s that someone actually found it there and worked out its role. And for a beer that had been studied so much, I find it amazing that it took that long to find out about it.
Wow. Well, stepping back a little bit in time, you mentioned I kind of find this whole thing of idea of fermenting in the mash tun interesting. It seems like if you ferment in the mash tun, you'd almost guarantee that you'd get lactobacillus in there just because, the grain's really full of it, right?
Yeah, I would have thought so. I mean, it is nowadays, so I can't imagine that's changed at all. Yeah, so I hadn't thought of that, actually.
Yeah.
Actually, that might be the point.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the grains are full of lactobacillus and stuff like that. They have a lot of wild, typically have a lot of wild yeast associated with them, and it's only the boiling process that takes them out. So if you take your boiled wort, throw it back in the mash tun, it seems like you're virtually guaranteeing it's going to be sour, right?
Yeah, I really hadn't looked at it that way, but it does make, and then I can see why they might have done it.
Kind of interesting.
But I mean, if you've got wort that's got very low rates of hopping, and you've got lots of wooden equipment around that's coming into direct contact with the wort,
yeah,
I'd thought you've got massive chances of getting lactobacillus in there.
And like I said, in addition to grain, so it's interesting. So how did the style sort of evolve as we started to enter the 1800s? I think you mentioned there's some other descriptions that kind of show maybe something a little bit different.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be that, I mean, one of the changes is to the way that it was served, and it goes to being a bottled beer. So it's, I think, even before primary fermentation's finished, it's shipped out, I think, mostly to pubs. And then they'd finish off the primary fermentation and then bottle it. And then it seems age it for different periods as well. So possibly serve some of it young, possibly age some, often watering it down when it was bottled. Seems to have been a common practice.
So did it become a sort of a lighter beer at this point, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think at this period it was still being brewed. It was mostly a shank beer, but I mean, it's been various strengths at various points. It's not always just been a low gravity beer. But I think, yeah, generally at this point it was becoming mostly a shank beer. So something between.
So I'm sorry. What do you mean by shank beer? I don't really understand that.
Shank beer is a German classification. Mm-hmm. So that's what Berliner Weisse is classified as today. It's a shank beer.
Okay.
So I think the current one is about 7 degrees to 9 degrees Plato, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So fairly light.
Yeah. So something fairly light. So it literally means draft beer. It's the equivalent of the Czech term Vychepní pivo, which is the sort of 10 degree Czech lager, but the German version's a bit weaker. But yeah, so I think it's mostly being brewed at that strength by this point.
And are they using similar techniques? Are they still doing the decoction? Are they still actually fermenting in the mash tun?
No, they ferment. They start go to fermenting in casks, so in barrels.
Uh huh.
And then doing this process that sounds very much like something in the UK was called cleansing, where when you've got violent fermentation, you collect the stuff that the foam that comes out of the top, and then recycle the liquid from it back into the cask.
So top, I guess they're harvesting yeast off the top. Is that essentially what they? I mean, they would have known that then, but
well, yeah, it's probably they knew what yeast was. They just didn't know exactly what sort of organism it was, but they knew plenty about yeast.
Right.
Well, mostly it's a way of getting the yeast out of the beer and making sure you don't lose any of the beer just by throwing over the top. I mean, the Burton Union system is a sort of semi-automated version of this.
Yeah, I think I'm very familiar with the Burton Union system, so that makes sense, where they obviously harvest off the top, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And recycle the beer back into the cask. So mm-hmm. in general, what the process is doing is removing yeast from the wort.
Mm-hmm.
What else were they doing in the early 19th century? Well, this is it's the middle of the century when they move away from smoke malt, which is something that really surprised me, that Berliner Weisse had been a smoke beer. So I assume that at one point it had been more like Lichtenhainer.
Well, I think we've discussed this before, but most beers were smoked beers before, you know, like the late 1700s, just because almost everything was malted with wood, right?
Yeah.
To some degree, right?
No, and this is the weird thing, that normally it was Weisse beer that wasn't.
Okay.
So, I mean, you used to have the two classifications of malt and the two classifications of beer, uh-huh. general types in Germany, which were... Weisse beer and brown beer.
Hmm.
Brown beer being stuff that had been malted, had been dried in a kiln,
mm-hmm.
so it was likely to be darker in colour, and this probably was quite often pretty smoky. And then Weisse beer, which was made from Weisse malt, which was air dried.
Interesting.
And so there was no smoke involved in its production, which is why I find it quite odd.
So they made the malt without kilning it? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I mean, that's how that's what traditionally was used for Belgian wit beer as well, was air dried malt.
Hmm. And I assume they did this with both wheat and barley as well?
Yes, which is why you have to be very careful looking at older German texts. When it says Weisse beer, it doesn't necessarily mean that there was any wheat involved in the production.
Hmm.
And this is one of the interesting things with this really detailed analysis in this one book from the VLB about. Look at these Berliner Weisses in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that one of them doesn't have any wheat in it at all. It's 100% barley beer.
But it was called a Weisse beer, obviously, right?
But it was a Berliner Weisse. But this is perfectly fair enough because the Weisse bit does not refer to wheat. And so Bräuheim, that I mentioned earlier, is a typical Weisse beer. But I've seen plenty of recipes for it which were 100% barley.
Hmm.
It's and you find that with a lot of these North German beers, what they used varied, and I'm sure the reason it varied, it depended on what they had at the time. So if they got enough wheat, then they put wheat in it, and if not, they just brew 100% barley beer.
So do you think this is true with the original Berliner Weisse or not? That they actually mixed the malts around a lot, or did it have a component of wheat at all times?
It wouldn't surprise me if it didn't always.
Hmm.
And at one time it also had oats in it, which makes it very much like the sort of beers that you see over the other end, much further west in Holland and in Belgium, where a typical beer would consist of wheat, barley, and oats.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, later in the early 1900s, we find more historical descriptions, and I think the beer has evolved even a little bit more. What's changed at this point?
A higher percentage of wheat, so that's now 3/4 rather than 2/3. So I'm sure that varied a lot. That's just sort of like an average, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That won't have been consistent across breweries, but yeah, it seems to be more wheat. There's still boiling weirdly, but what they're doing now is boiling the hops in the water that they were going to use for mashing and then leaving the hops in as well.
So say that again. I don't fully understand. So they mash some of the hops or something?
No, they boil the hops in water.
Okay.
And then use that water with the hops still in it for the mash.
Interesting. What would that do? Maybe lower the pH a little? I don't know.
I don't know. I think, again, it's trying to avoid having the boiling phase.
I mean, I know at one time homebrewers were using like a mash hops, which seems ridiculous to me, but I think one positive effect it had, it probably lowered the pH a little bit, you know?
Okay. Well, in this case, the possible advantage was it helped the mash filter. Because there was a high percentage of wheat in the in the grist.
Mm, interesting. So maybe helped a little bit with the viscosity, possibly?
Yeah, or just making the mash bed a bit less dense.
Right, right. So
I don't know, but
that was apparently a popular technique, huh?
Yeah, though again, I'm sure it varied from brewery to brewery. Because these were very traditional places, so I'm sure they'd all develop their own slightly different techniques. Hmm. I mean, one thing that you do have in this period is that, you know, for definite that there were like four different strengths of Weissbier. So the one that we normally get now, then ones of what you call 12-degree Plato, 14-degree Plato, and 16-degree Plato. So the strength of Bock beer, the strongest one.
Hmm. So the one today is the strongest that would have been around in the 19th century? I'm sorry, no, 20th century?
It's the weakest one.
The weakest one, yeah. So, but there were stronger versions at that time, right?
Yeah. Though again, whether they were sold at that strength is another matter, seeing as they might have been watered down at some point.
Hmm. And do you believe, I mean, what did it taste like at this point? Did you think it tasted anything like the Berliner Weiss that we get today?
I think by 1900, it probably tasted pretty much like what I would call the authentic style of Berliner Weisse, which is the stuff that I was drinking in the 1980s. When I was lucky enough to get to drink a lot of the East Berlin Schulteis, which is an absolutely brilliant beer.
Hmm. And you mentioned that's no longer made, unfortunately.
No, that's no longer made. So I mean, I think the beer around 1900 probably tasted pretty similar to that.
Hmm.
So very effervescent, very sour, bit of Brett character, very light.
Yeah, drinkable is what I think. I always want a, you know, a beer like this. Now, the style maintained its popularity at least well into the late 20th century. What did the style look like at this point? Obviously, the lighter style is more popular at this point, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Berliner Weisse went into slow decline.
Mm-hmm.
And around the time of World War One, or immediately after it,
is when it started to lose some popularity.
Yes, well, I mean, what you see this interesting phenomenon in Germany in the last couple of decades of the 19th century, where the amount of top fermenting beer being brewed in North Germany stays about the same.
Okay.
But the amount of bottom fermenting beer brewed, something like quadruples.
Hmm.
So you can see that there's a lot of new trade for brewers, but it's all taken by the new breweries, by the new bottom fermenting ones, which mostly operate on a much larger scale. And so you can see that the Berliner Weisse breweries were pretty typical of the older generation of North German breweries,
mm-hmm.
in that they were very small, didn't have very sophisticated equipment, and brewed a product for a specific group of customers. What you could say if you look at what happened in most of Germany is that you could be asking, well, how come Berliner Weisse managed to survive? Because most styles like this disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Berliner Weisse was really the lone survivor of a whole range of different sour beers or partially sour beers that you had in North Germany.
And those, so, I assume, were pushed out by the, you know, three or four top styles, right?
Yeah, they just, well, I mean, I suppose their customers died off is probably what happens. This is normally how it goes with beer styles, that at a certain point they become unfashionable and they don't attract any new drinkers.
Hmm.
And they just die out when the last of the old customers dies.
Now, you mentioned the fall of the Berlin Wall played a big role in the demise, particularly of a lot of the Berliner Weisse breweries, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, what you had happened, there'd been, at the time of the fall of the wall, there were three breweries in Berlin producing Berliner Weisse. So
mm-hmm.
Schulteis in the east and Kindle and Schulteis in the west.
Mm-hmm.
And they all ended up under the same ownership eventually. So inevitably, most of the breweries and all but one of the types of Berliner Weisse were just finished. So yeah, it's.
So how long did that take? You mentioned being able to get still get the good East German version in the 80s. Did it take 20 years, or how long did it take to completely disappear?
No, I think the Eastman Schulthaus, I think that was bought up and closed within a year or two of the fall of the wall.
So that would have been quickly. Like 1990 then, right?
Yeah, sometime in the early 90s. It really wasn't very long. And then Kindle and Schulthaus merged. I can't remember when that was. I think that was in the 90s sometime as well, but the late 90s. So it's just unfortunate that's the way things turned out. But, I mean, it didn't help that, I mean, if you look at the quantities that were being sold of Berliner Weisse, they were pretty small.
Yeah, that's another question I had. Was this ever more of a regional style, or was it really just kind of limited to the city?
Yeah, it was just, you only ever saw it in Berlin.
Huh. So it never became really popular outside, in other places in northern Germany, I guess?
No, I mean, at one point they all had their own individual styles, and then when they disappeared, they didn't import Berliner Weisse instead. I mean, they just went over to drinking lagers.
And I mean, was lager the major factor in the steady decline of Berliner Weisse or not?
Yeah, I mean, so you see that. I mean, people like Kindle and Schulthaus, their main business wasn't brewing Berliner Weisse. Their main business was brewing pale lager. And they were companies which were of the new wave of breweries. So things which were limited companies, had lots of capital, bought fancy new breweries. Worked on a much more commercial basis than the older bottom fermenting breweries, and were able to outcompete them quite easily, I think.
And so, even though the style has declined and almost disappeared in Germany, there's a huge number of craft breweries here in the United States that have picked it up. How's the U.S. variation of Berliner Weisse different than the German one?
It's hard for me to say because normally I don't try them because I'm just sort of dreading what they'll be like. One thing is that they're often stronger than the Shankbier strength, so often they're 4.5-5%, at least the ones I remember seeing.
Oh yeah, I would say that's probably true. I think I mentioned most of them, a large portion of them are kettle soured. This is a traditional way for making it here, at least. So
yeah, I mean, that doesn't help, and then often there's fruit in them as well.
That's true too. Yeah, that is very true. I've had several that had fruit mixed in. So it's almost like a different style, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think hardly any of them have any sort of, have the proper type of fermentation. And so they're never going to taste like a proper Berliner Weisse, because you have to ferment it a certain way, otherwise it doesn't taste right.
So do they, I guess a traditional one was fermented in a traditional manner, really, with sour beer, right? They used the Brettanomyces and the yeast at the same time, right?
Well, no, Brettanomyces and Lactobacillus. And then only the, you've got two types of sour beers. You've got beers which are sour during primary fermentation.
Right.
Beers which are sour during secondary fermentation.
Right.
When it's primary fermentation, it's usually done by Lactobacillus. Mm-hmm. When it's secondary fermentation, it's usually Brettanomyces or Brettanomyces and something like Pediococcus.
Uh-huh.
So things that take longer.
And the traditional method for this style was what?
With Lactobacillus. In, right. So souring in during primary fermentation.
So they would have been soured that way first, and then would they use the yeast at the same time or no?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, okay.
The two were fermenting simultaneously.
Right, that's what I understood as well.
And then at the end, then you get Brettanomyces coming in, and then the beer was probably continuing to get sour in the bottle because it still have yeast and still have Lactobacillus and Brettanomyces in there, so. It's not like it was a sterile environment.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's quite a bit different than what we're seeing here. Like I said, with a lot of the U.S. ones, which are made, more kettle sour method.
Right? Yeah, well, I'm sure it's a lot easier and a lot more reliable to do it that way.
Yeah, it's more consistent. It's certainly faster. That's the big thing for breweries, obviously.
Yeah.
It's much quicker. Did it take a lot of time to brew the traditional Berliner Weisse?
Well, Not in the brewery, because it's only really primary fermentation that used to take place in the brewery. And then the secondary fermentation in the bottle, that you'd already have sold the beer by the time that happened. I mean, obviously, you know, after the war, then you get it more conventional where it's just being bottled and then shipped out. So, but I think it was still pretty quickly. Because I think that some landlords or some customers would age the beer before they drank it.
So it was, I assume it was still souring in the bottle then, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense. Do you think the U.S. Version of Berliner Weiss, the craft beer style, may keep it alive, at least in some form now?
Well, yeah, zombie form.
Zombie form, huh?
I don't know. I'm sure there are people who do it properly. Yes, they usually are. You just have to hunt them down because, I mean, I've also had some pretty dreadful American lagers, but I know that there are, well, at least I've come across several breweries who know how to do them properly. So there might be some, there probably are some people who are brewing Berliner Weiss in the proper way in the States.
Yeah, I like many brewers, will go to a brewery and order their Pilsner because I know that if the Pilsner is really good, the rest of it's probably pretty good too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a beer like Helles.
It's hard to make a good Pilsner, right?
Yeah, but those really pale lager styles, they're the most tricky technically.
Right, right.
You know, anyone can brew an Imperial Stout. You just throw loads of everything in.
Right, exactly. You know, where do you think's the future of Berliner Weiss? Is it gonna live on in craft beer only, or do you think maybe it'll just linger on in Berlin?
Well, I mean, it does seem to have got a little bit better in Berlin. I'm a bit out of touch, but I think at least you've got Schnee Euler, and I think there might be one or two other people doing it on a small scale, but nothing very big yet. But at least some people are trying it, and. Yeah, if they can create a little bit of interest in the style, especially amongst younger drinkers, then maybe there'll be more business in it in the future. I mean, I'd like to see them do well and you know, grow the size of the breweries. But yeah, it's
and you mentioned there's only one left, really, right? So is that one close to the historical style, or is it not?
No, it was the worst of the...
The worst of the bunch, of course.
Yeah, it was the worst of the three. Because this is the one where they do a split fermentation. I mean, they used to. I'm sure that my guess is they probably still do.
So the weakest survived, apparently, huh?
Yeah, I never liked it very much. Well, I did have some bottles, a couple of bottles that I hadn't drunk with because they'd been so not very good when they were fresh. I sort of left them for ages. And then I tried them, and they're okay, actually, after a couple of years. So something had been going on. Certainly much better than they were fresh.
Well, I want to get your closing thoughts on the history of Berliner Weiss, and then maybe we got a minute or two left, so maybe we can talk about your latest book. But let's talk about what are your closing thoughts on Berliner Weiss and kind of where it's going now?
Well, sort of limited optimism, I'd say. I mean, at least people have... sort of trying to brew it. It seems to be picking up a bit in Berlin again, which I think is most important. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if the style isn't brewed in its home city, then that's pretty sad.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm glad to see that people are trying to bring it back. So, yeah, sort of mildly optimistic.
I would say it's still fairly popular at the craft beer level here, though. A lot of people like to, a lot of breweries like to make it because it's a relatively fast, you know, sour beer that they can serve. So
yeah.
So hopefully,
yeah. I mean, I can see its appeal. And I mean, people in the States were always going to play around with it, weren't they?
It's always a drinkable sour beer too, which is when, you know, another thing that's attractive. You know, some of the more exotic, bizarre sour beers are really more of a niche product. You know. So.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it's got fairly wide appeal for the device.
It does.
It's like Goza. It's, you know, it's just a sort of light, nice summer beer.
Okay, well, we've got just a couple minutes left. I thought maybe I'd give you a chance to talk about you. You mentioned your book is coming out fairly soon on World War II, I believe, right?
Yeah, hopefully. I keep sort of finding new bits to add to it. It was essentially finished about 6 months ago. But
so tell us, obviously we had you on for an episode on the World War II brewing in Britain, but tell us a little more about some of the things you've added and how the book's kind of coming together.
Well, I mean, it's mostly there. It's got, I think, 550 recipes, mm-hmm. so quite a lot. But I mean, the reason there's lots of recipes is for most of the beers, I had to do a recipe for every year of the war because the recipe changed every year. Right. So it meant I had to do a lot of recipes if I wanted to tell the story through the recipes, which I partly wanted to do, so that you could say, well, I might say they had to use certain ingredients like barley and oats. But when you see how a beer changes and these ingredients come and sometimes go again, then you can say, this is what the practical results of that government policy were. So you can get tell quite a bit of the story through the recipes as well as in the main text section. Hmm. So that's going to be one volume. It's going to be volume two. It's going to be the recipes. And then volume one is going to be just the more factual information.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we talked about it before, but, you know, obviously all the breweries were hit by severe shortages during the war and had to make mass substitutions, right, as they were going?
Yeah, well, no, they were told to make various substitutions. I mean, some of it was because they diverted quite a lot of the barley towards bread. Mm-hmm. But they also, I mean, the thing about, they also at a certain point made them use flake barley rather than malt. And the reason they insisted on flake barley was for the simple reason that they didn't have enough labor to produce the malt. There was a labor crisis in the malting industry. And so if they just made the brewers use the flake version instead.
So they didn't have to malt it, I guess, right?
Yeah, so they didn't have to malt it.
Interesting.
So it's sort of strange things like that happened. And then 1943, when the brewers had to put oats into all the beers, that was a fun one.
Wow.
Not very popular with brewers.
Interesting time. Well, Ron, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you coming to talk a little bit more about Berliner Weisse.
Yeah, well, I hope people will find it interesting. I think it's an interesting style and with an interesting history. So,
well, thanks, Ron. Again, my guest today was Ron Pattinson. Ron is the author of dozens of books on historical brewing, and he runs a blog, which you can find at BarclayPerkins.blogspot.com. Thanks again, Ron. Appreciate you coming here.
No problem.
Well, a big thank you to Ron Pattinson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And the web-based version of Beersmith with the new inventory module is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or your mobile device. You can try Beersmith Web free for 30 days by setting up an account at BeersmithRecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out BeersmithRecipes.com today to give it a try. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.